Session number 5201, reel 5.
Wartime filming, Martin Gray, reel 5.
Well, we came back to England and had a refit in which the car was completely done up and the engine done and everything, all the equipment was serviced and redone up because it was in a pretty poor state, having had a year's hard bashing. Anyway, we had Christmas there, and then we went back in January, I think it was, January 44, back in to catch up with the Second Army in on their Swan up the coast. We went into Brussels, and from Brussels we went on up through Holland, following behind them, eventually caught them up near the Rhine, where they'd been stopped, of course, by the Rhine itself. And we did the Rhine crossing eventually. We crossed when they took the Rhine and went on. And it was all general sort of filming of events and so on, a bit of sound of troops talking and so on, what they were doing and how it had all gone and so on. And one preoccupation, as far as I was concerned, is I want to get my brother-in-law out of prisoner of war camp. He'd been taken on D plus 3 of D-Day. And I knew where he was, and we eventually got to the camp. But what happened was we got to the town, Fallingbostel, where he was, or near where he was, and the Germans were still in the town. Oh, literally only 100, 200 yards down the road, around the corner. And I was with the Reuter correspondent. He was with us, and I said, "Well, that's it. I'll have to wait." And he said, "Well, what do you?" And he said, "I want a story." He said, "Come with me. I'll take you across in the jeep." So we went over in the jeep to the camp, which had been visited by armored vehicles previously, and the British commandant of the camp had taken over the camp and got the Russian guard, Russian guards, the Wehrmacht, the old Wehrmacht, who were the prison people of 60 and 70, they were then guarding the prisoners against the SS under the command of the British commandant. So we eventually went in and got surrounded, and God knows how many bits of paper we signed, and there was autographs and so on, and gave what cigarettes we had out and so on. And the sergeant next to me said, I said, "Well, hang on a minute, hang on, I've got getting writer's cramp. Where's my brother-in-law?" I said, "Who's your brother-in-law?" I said, "Sergeant Stacy." He said, "Where's Stacy?" And there he was only 20 feet away from me, but couldn't get at me because of the crush was so much. Anyway, we went back again, and we picked up. I said, "Well, I must go out. I'll come back again, and we'll film you all. Let everybody at home know that you're all safe and well." Because they'd been taken out and taken on a route march up and been brought back to the camp because they'd been strafed by British fighters. So we went back, and we came back in, and we did all the filming and so on, and it was great stuff. And then we went on up, and then we were told about Belsen. Belsen was a shocking thing, there's no doubt about it. And I took a lot of pictures of my own of it, which I showed people afterwards, and people, and Germans particularly, and people wouldn't believe it. Even British people wouldn't believe it.
Why would they not believe it?
They said they were fake. They said that people couldn't do a thing like this. I got terribly irate over this with people because I said, "Look, I'm not a liar. I was there. I took the pictures. I know this is true. If you'd have been there, you'd known it was true too."
Were these well-informed people who?
Oh, these are people in this country.
Fake?
Yes, yes, yes. Who thought they didn't believe this sort of thing could happen? The ordinary run-of-the-mill people in the street.
Were they suspicious of these pictures, perhaps?
Yes.
Because the newsreels had a reputation for staging events before the war?
Yes, because, there was a point at one time at which a certain part of the filming was staged. There's no doubt about that. And this was staged in North Africa. We'll not go into that, because that's old history. But
this didn't come to the attention of the public, I think, if
but a lot of people, thinking people, sort of wondered how the cameramen could get shots as they did in front of guns and so on with, this sort of thing. But the people just didn't believe that people could be so bestial in their treatment of human beings. And I had terrific arguments with people over this. And I, matter of fact, I haven't got the pictures now because I lent them to a ex-German friend of mine, or rather ex, when I say German, his wife was German. And I kept asking for him back, and he said he would keep giving to me back, but he never did, so I didn't press it. So I wasn't all that interested in it, really, because I knew what I'd seen, and that was all. But the arrogance of some of the Germans, even after they were caught red-handed in the place, and we had them up against the background and made them, for these, all the pictures which we took of the interviews in which they were told to state their name, their rank, and who they were and what they did in the camp and so on, was all to the background of these bodies all around the place in these pits. And we had this little girl who'd only been in the camp 4 days. She was a Czech, and she had a... She was our interpreter, telling them what to do, what to say, where to stand, and so on. And they all thought they were going to be shot and toppled into the pit along with the bodies. It was quite a frightening thing to think the people, your own people, didn't believe you when you said that this, you had witnessed this thing and you had seen it. A lot of people went to the cinema and didn't believe it. You know that, didn't you?
But these interviews were deliberately designed in order to overcome these.
No, they weren't. They weren't done for that at all. The interviews were done for Nuremberg trials, and they were all screened at the Nuremberg trials of all the people concerned, Dr. Klein and people like this. They were all up there to say who they were, to identify them at the place concerned. We were asked to do this, matter of fact. We didn't think about this, but we were asked if we would do this for use later on. We didn't know what for, but it turned out to be for the Nuremberg trials.
Were there other occasions on which you were asked to record interviews in Germany?
No, only troop interviews. Only interviews with troops. Or possibly a unit or something
like
this.
Not interviews with any of the displaced people?
No, because most of the displaced people, very few of them spoke English anyway. They were all Poles and Czechs and Italians and so on, who spent their life looting what they could find when they were released. Because most of them were slave labour anyway. Not, they weren't in prisoner war camps, but they were slave labour in the factories and so on. No, after that, it was all, when it was obvious that everything was crumbling about, we went into Bremen, we went into Hamburg. The places were in ruins. And the fantastic thing I can never forget is one small town of Bocholtz, which was just completely razed by a bombing attack. It was a small country town, and you couldn't get in the town. Everywhere was blocked by rubble. This is way back. But this sort of thing was throughout Germany. And they couldn't believe that they were being overrun.
Did you feel any sympathy for the Germans?
No, not a bit. Not a bit. I think, like the Tommies in Belsen. I mean, if I'd have been in their position, I would have used a rifle butt, as they did very frequently, to remind them that they should be getting on and doing the job they were supposed to be doing. And, I mean, everybody turned a blind eye to it. But, I mean, in actual fact, if anybody's seen it, Red Cross or somebody has seen it, they raised Cain and hell about it. But, I mean, in basic fact, you cannot expect a human being not to react this way.
How much longer did you stay on in Germany after the end of the war?
Oh, not a great deal, because we were back in London fairly soon. We came back... The car was brought back afterwards. We flew back. That's right, the car was brought back later. We flew back because we were wanted back in England.
Paul Wyand recalls in his reminiscences how you filmed him being kissed by the Russians. Was this your first experience with a camera?
No, as I said to you earlier on, my first experience with the camera was at Boulogne and then the BEF. Yes, but I did. I did. I went, climbed on top of the camera. I said to him, go on, out you go. You're going to fraternise with your fellow. And I filmed him.
But this was the start of your new career as a cameraman, is that correct?
I suppose so, if you like to say it. It didn't happen for another year or 18 months afterwards, but it could have been the start of it, yes. That was quite incredible, that trip up there, because we heard that there had been a link-up. The 6th Airborne Division were on their way up to link up with the Russians. And we got in the car with Bill Warhurst, and we drove up. And, of course, we met all the German forces coming towards us. And in lots of cases, trying to surrender arms to us. And we were telling them to go to the local Mary and surrender their arms there, because in all the local towns outside the Mary were piles and piles of arms, rifles, submachine guns and everything else, where they'd all been told to throw them and walk on back down unarmed. And we didn't mind this. It was quite easy, but our only fear was that we'd come up against the SS, who were still very awkward and very difficult. And, of course, if you come up against the SS, you were liable to be shot without even thinking about it. So although we weren't supposed to be armed, we were. We'd managed to procure ourselves a submachine gun, a Thompson machine gun. And just in case we came up against any problems, but we didn't. And we got up to the 6th Airborne Division headquarters and got hold of their PRO man. And he took us out to the Russians, and we met them, and there was a great big fraternising job with the Tommies and the 6th Airborne blokes and the tanks, the Russian tanks, and as you said, and Paul, I made Paul go in, and we filmed him in there. And then they said, there was one Russian speaking quite good English, and he said, Colin, you better come back and follow me. And it was that we followed them, and we finished up in a great big chateau. And we went in, and it was full of Russian army officers, and there was a great big vodka party going on. And we joined this, and we had a wonderful evening with them. And nobody could speak English. It was all back slapping and down the hatch and throwing the glasses into the fireplace, which was a great big mound of grass going bigger by the moment. God knows where they found all the glasses from, but they did. And we eventually left to go back in the dark, and I said to Paul, well, we've got to find our way back. I don't know which. I think I know which way we came. And we found our way back and came to the barrier was then down, and the torch was thrust in the car in our face, and a very cultured voice said, did you have a nice party, gentlemen? We said, fabulous, thank you very much. He said, well, have a pleasant journey. Lift the barrier. Good night. It was a Russian army officer. Good night. And so we went back. The only other thing I can remember is going up then to Flensburg to when they collected Admiral Dönitz and Jodl and people like this. But after that, we were then recalled back to London. And from then on, of course, I mean, we were back in London for VJ Day, but not for VE Day, because that had all gone past. When we got back.
You left out the account of the surrender at Lüneburg.
Ah, yes. Yes, I had forgotten about that. How could I forget it? It's quite incredible. We were called in by Jeff Keating and said that there's something special. Keep it under your hat. There's something special we want to do. You're not to tell anybody. And, of course, we had to keep it away from all our other correspondent people that we were going out and where we were going. And we had to find some lights. We got some lights of our own, but we hadn't got enough. We managed to scrounge the rest from other people. So we wanted lights. Said, what do you want it for? We said, we don't know, but we told we want lights. So anyway, we went down there and to Monty's headquarters, and it turned out to be exactly what it was going to be, the surrender. And we had to light up a tent, one of these big army tents. There was a table in the middle. We had to light it up with photo floods, and they'd given us a generator. And we lit it, and we put all the... We didn't light it up. All you did was put the lights down the centre. You couldn't do any fancy lighting. We hadn't got the equipment for it anyway. And we got it all rigged up, and Monty came in, and said, "Are you all right, gentlemen? Is everything all right?" We said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Well, what's going to happen?" He said, "Well, I'm going to take the surrender." He said, "Well, the German army?" "Yes, sir." "Yes, sir." "Well, yes," he said, "the surrender." He said, "We said, could you tell us what's going to happen, please? Because we'd like to know." Paul said this, I didn't, but I was interested as well, because I wanted to know where to put the microphones and so on. And he said, "Well, we also have the BBC there." "That's right." And he said, "Well, I'm going to come in here, and they will come in over here and stand here, and I will sit down and I will read out the terms of their surrender." And we said, "Yes." "And do they reply?" He said, "No, they have no right of prize at all." He said, "They'll either take it or leave it. If they don't like it, we'll fight on." Anyway, he said, "That's what will happen." And sure enough, to the moment, exactly, it happened exactly as he said it would, and they all filed, looking like sheep, and came in, and he stood up there, and he read out the terms of surrender. They sort of said, "Now, you sign here, I'll sign here," and everybody signed them and what have you. Then he said, and he left them. He said, "And I'll leave you here," and he walked out. And it would be pouring down with rain outside. It was bucketing down. And I was in the car, and Paul, of course, as I told you earlier, the car, the cameras got very hot, very, very, with this 400 volts, they got very live. And Paul had rapped on my window, and he said, "Look," he said, "I can't start this camera and stop it," he said, "because it's too hot, too lively." He said, "Take it off the battery, I'll switch it on," and he said, "I'll knock on the window when I want you to start and stop. One to start, two to stop." I said, "Okay, fine." So I was running the camera for him, because he was just pointing it and doing what was necessary, and starting and stopping it from the battery inside. And while I'm doing this, outside the tent, up on the side here, where all the connectors were, where they were connected to the jet, they were all sparking. The water was getting in them, they were all going... I thought, "God, I hope it lasts." Luckily, it all lasted. And when Monty had gone and the Germans were still sitting there, and then the British aide-de-camps had come in and were sort of collecting out the papers and talking to them and telling them what to do, all of a sudden one of these lights went bang and went all over the top of Freiburg's head. You've never seen anybody jump so much in all your life. He'd only been shot, I think. So that was the signing. It was all over so quickly once he'd done it. You know, we never stopped turning the camera from one end to the other, more or less, except to the point when Paul wanted to change position, when it was the signing and he wanted more different shots and so on. That's when he asked me to do the switching on and off for him. It's quite an incredible story. We didn't know anything about it at all. We knew it had all crumbled around our ears, and that the war was over, the German army had crumbled. But we didn't know that this was to be the actual signing.
Could you very briefly describe your post-war career?
Yes, I think my post-war career is I then, after about a year, I became a cameraman, a rookie cameraman, and I spent a large percentage of my life filming sports, cup finals, cricket, Australian test matches, all sorts of football, FA Cup matches, rugby. I was supposed to be an ace at rugby. I don't know whether it was true or not, but they used to say I was. And I used to travel all around the country, Cardiff, Lansdowne Road, Ireland, Scotland, Murrayfield, and so on. And also, amongst other things, obviously, Princess Elizabeth's coronation and leaving. When her father... I was involved with Paul at London Airport when she left to go to Kenya. When
back with the sound.
No, I wasn't. No, I was on camera then. We were two cameramen then. I was a sound cameraman then. Paul was the sound cameraman. We'd got two sound units there. I was then on sound as a cameraman, not as a recordist. And of course, also when she came back after Kenya, when he died, the funeral, naturally. I spent most of my life outside on royal occasions on the Queen Victoria Memorial. doing the arrivals and departures from the palace on ceremonial occasions, trooping the colour. And, of course, the wedding, the funeral, I was on the wedding cake, as we used to call it. And for the coronation, I spent all from about 5 o'clock in the morning to about 11 o'clock at night on the Queen Victoria Memorial, doing the actual arrival, going, coming back, and also on the balcony and all this sort of thing.
What made you decide to work for ITV?
I thought it was a coming thing and that it wouldn't be a bad idea, because I was convinced, along with most people, that the cinema newsreel, or the cinema generally, was in for a bad time when television really got going. And that the television news, the ordinary news, cinema newsreel, as one knew, was going to be a dead end. It must be, because, I mean, television is going to kill it stone cold as a news medium. The only way you could use it then was as a magazine programme. And, of course, I was proved right, as most of us were, because a lot of us went over. I mean, the whole of the ITN news staff were all news television newsmen. Not television, but, I mean... Are you run out? No. Television... newsroom men into television.
Thank you very much indeed.
Pleasure. I hope it's all you want.